It's Lions, Towers, and Shields from the Incomparable Network. I'm Shelley, your host, and this is episode 45, Pickup on South Street. 1953's Pickup on South Street, directed by Sam Fuller, but I cannot do that alone. I have my intrepid panelist, Mr. Nathan Alderman, joining me. Hi.
Hi. For some reason now, I really want muffins.
Don't we all? Yes. There will be muffins served in the green room after the show with cannons. Pickup on South Street is a film noir with a side of commie hunting, and it stars Richard Widmark, Gene Peters, the great Thelma Ritter, and a guy whose name I had actually never spoken in my life, named Mervyn Y, who is a cop. We have to talk about Tiger a little bit later. But let me start by asking you, Nathan, what's your history with this movie? Was this another one that I talked you into seeing for the first time, or did you know it before?
I had seen it about 20 years ago, maybe? Oh, gosh. How? yes, sorry. My brief grappling with my own mortality aside. Yeah, I saw it about 20 years ago, back when Netflix still offered DVDs and was basically like the best film school you could get for $12 a month. And I really enjoyed it. But in my memory, I mixed it up with Night in the City, which is another movie in which Richard Widmark plays a sleazy, desperate protagonist and which has a much darker ending. So I was expecting this to end tragically, and I was very surprised when it did not.
Well, we'll get to the ending, but I guess that's when my one sort of, wait, what? Sort of criticism of this movie, because it doesn't seem to go with the rest of it. Richard Widmark specialized in playing sleazeballs, and he didn't always do it. That's the thing. Like, he was not always the villain or the psychopath. He played plenty of big-hatted heroes and westerns and action guys, but the movies he's most remembered for are things like this and like Kiss of Death, which is his proto-sleazeball, his first film. And everybody saw him in Kiss of Death, and every time they saw him after that, it was like, oh, it's that Widmark guy. And so I guess if you've got a type and you're good at it, keep going.
Yeah, he's actually my biggest problem with this movie. It's not that he gives a bad performance. It's just that he is, well, we'll get to that later. He's a real piece of something in this movie.
Yeah, you could say that. We also have Gene Peters, who is unfortunately, I guess, most famous for being Howard Hughes's wife.
That poor woman.
Yeah, and that it didn't go too well. She was, I believe she was married to him at this time.
You're telling me Howard Hughes was not a good husband? That can't be right.
Oddly, he was not. And then we have the great Thelma Ritter, Oscar nominated but not a winner for this movie. She played some version of this kind of character in other movies, but I think this is one where she's not only doing a great job, but she's truly a sympathetic character, and you really feel for her as you go through the movie and want to go on her journey with her. And there's a point at which you get really mad at another character because of how he treats her.
Yep. This was Thelma Ritter's fourth year in a row of getting nominated but not winning the Best Supporting Actor Oscar. Donna Reed somehow won the Best Supporting Actress Oscar this year for From Here to Eternity. Look, I've never seen From Here to Eternity. Maybe it's a great movie. I have seen It's a Wonderful Life, and I love Donna Reed in that. But Donna Reed can burn in hell because Thelma Ritter deserved the Oscar for this movie. She deserved 5 Oscars for this movie.
I agree with you, and I will say that Donna Reed's performance in From Here to Eternity is revelatory in that she's not being Donna Reed. She's actually playing a prostitute, but she's not Thelma Ritter, and therefore she shouldn't have won. So there. From Here to Eternity won a lot of awards, and she got one too. Too bad. And then I have to mention Mervyn Y. I feel like I've seen him in a ton of movies, and I looked him up, and it's that he's a TV actor. He would have been in a lot of 50s and 60s TV series as a guest star, and I really like him. He's just like got good cop energy, and it's just a delight to watch him. And I thought when Richard Widmark's character talks to him and calls him Tiger, that was just Richard Widmark's pet name for him, but everybody calls him Tiger.
Yes, he is Police Captain Dan Tiger, which sounds like the hero of a cheap airport novel, and I love it.
I know.
He's just like just big ball of sweaty belligerence. It's so great.
And directed by Sam Fuller, who would go on to do many other kinds of movies, It was interesting because I read some contemporary reviews of this film, which didn't like it. And I think they got sort of tied up in the whole communist. It's not even a subplot. It's just a device they use, that the bad guys are communists and that even the crooks are like, you know, I'm as crooked as the day is long, but at least I'm not a commie. And people sort of got caught up in that. In fact, Widmark was criticized, or Fuller, whoever wrote the dialogue for him, I guess it was Fuller, got the criticism for having Widmark say something about flag waving, as if mentioning that we were being a little bit flag wavy when we talked about communism might not be the best thing. But it was 1953.
The whole point is that Richard Widmark's character is a trash fire of a human being. So it's not like they're like, look at this bold, admirable hero taking his stand in favor of international communism, you know, and self-interest. He's a garbage person. And that is so I think this is a really well-directed movie. And it has wonderful dialogue, but I don't know if it's a very well-written movie, in part because Widmark's character is so poorly developed. It's like they just told him, okay, get out there and Widmark it up.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And I think, like, yeah, I struggle again. I mean, I guess we have to at least approach the ending in some way, because we have to believe that he either evolves or was a guy all along who could walk out of the police station at the end of the story with a woman on his arm, and that he was going to go straight, which isn't really borne out by the movie, not necessarily in terms of the writing, but just in terms of what little character development you get of Richard Widmark, the character. And he does Widmark it up, but he doesn't ham it up. Like, it's, I mean, if you watch Kiss of Death, Kiss of Death, there he's hamming it up. There he's like legitimately terrifying as a human, whatever he says in that movie and whatever in the laugh he does and the whole thing. This movie, he's a guy who does and has done bad things and who has a way of speaking, but just being generically terrifying is not really part of what he does. I mean, he's a pickpocket. He's not a super thuggy guy, with a couple of exceptions in this movie. You get the sense that he makes his living stealing from people.
Yeah, he's just a terrible human being. He's just a venal, self-interested weasel who is garbage to everyone around him, except maybe Thelma Ritter. And the weird thing is, like, there was an opportunity for the movie to have him. So I'm sorry to tell you, classic film fans, but Thelma Ritter does not make it out of this movie alive. And there was a moment when the script could have believably developed his character. He does something nice for Thelma Ritter after she dies, and yes, that is believable. That's like, you can believe that this. But then, like, he pretends with Jean Peters, who is falling all over herself to help him, and he still treats her like garbage. You know, he pretends that he actually cares about, you know, Thelma Ritter's death. And then the instant Gene Peters gives up the piece of information he wants, he just turns that right off. And he's like, haha, you sucker. You thought I had human emotions? Well, that's your problem. Oh, he's so terrible, which makes his flip flop at the end. You know, wait a minute. They beat up my girlfriend. Only I'm allowed to do that. Because, yes, their meet cute is that he punches her in the face, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. His flip-flop at the end of the movie is completely unbelievable. There are so many ways in which, I mean, the dialogue in this film crackles. It is beautiful. It's so much fun. All the lingo of cannons and muffins and, you know, the back and forth between Thelma Ritter's character, and Tiger. And I almost wonder if Thelma Ritter's character was written for a man and then Samuel Fuller was like, wait, Thelma Ritter is awesome. Never mind.
I love that as headcanon. I think, I don't know, I've never heard that, but that's great. And I think that he would have been an inspired genius had he decided to go from making her some sort of weaselly, gunsily guy, and then to changing him to Thelma Ritter, because she's perfect.
I mean, Thelma Ritter, yet again, her character on the page is pretty good, but Thelma Ritter makes it amazing, because it could have been shtick that Mo, so Mo is a snitch. Mo ostensibly sells men's neckwear, but that's just her cover for buying and selling information about the underworld. And it's not personal with her. She's not the kind of person who would, you know, sell out a person who didn't have it coming, or if she thought that person would really be in trouble. She wouldn't do that, as she demonstrates in the movie. But, you know, it's all in the game if, you know, she gives up a guy here or there if he has it coming. But her whole ambition in this movie is to save up enough money to die, which...
Yeah, they give her this motivation, which is intended to make her even more sympathetic. Because I think there's a way, discounting Thelma Ritter's incredible abilities, but there's a way in which, just as a stoolie who is entirely motivated by, you know, what little she can get, and she's not making a lot of money on each transaction, there's a way in which that construction would make her a very uninteresting character. But they give her this sort of sentimental thing about, I want enough money so that when I die, I don't have to be buried in the Potter's Field, which tugs at everybody's heartstrings, including Richard Widmark's. And it's kind of an interesting choice. It's like the ending. They've chosen to put this sort of sweetness and sentimentality into it. And I don't know how I feel about the Thelma Ritter part. I know how I feel about the ending. I hate it. But I don't know how I feel about giving her this specific motivation that everybody can feel for.
Well, again, it works because she's so great. It could have been just cheap shtick. There are some lines that could have been corny but are genuinely funny the way she delivers them, where she's like, I've got to save up to get into this really exclusive cemetery. Like, you know, people are literally dying to get in there. She has some great lines right. that I can't do justice. But the way she plays it, the weight that she gives it, the slyness and the humanity that she invests this role with, it's astonishing. And I feel like they don't set up the fact that, like, all of a sudden toward her last scenes, all of a sudden she's like, I'm exhausted and I'm ready to die. And you don't get any of that from her early scenes, because on her early scenes, she's snappy and she's like got her little book of prices for how much she charges to sell people out. And she's given it as good as she gets with Captain Tiger and like selling guys neckwear as part of her whole spiel. So it doesn't really land. They have to have her say, gosh, I'm really tired. I'm so exhausted. I'm ready to just lie down and die right here. And that doesn't work as well, except that it's Thelma Ritter. She can do anything, and she breaks your heart with what could have been a rote stoolie role.
Well, in that great last scene, though, when she knows her time is near, and when Danny has come and he's going to kill her, and she knows it, and the whole scene is focused on her. It's a close-up of her, and she's basically sort of hemming and hawing. She knows what's going to happen, and she's kind of like, you know, get it over with. But and she does that so well, and I think it's directed incredibly well too. And you know, at that point you're like, I don't really care whether there's realism. Wouldn't he have shot her 5 minutes before she did that speech? I don't care. Let Thelma talk.
Yeah, no, you wouldn't have shot her 5 minutes before she began that speech, because she's so interesting that even if you intended to kill her, you would wait until she was done speaking. And yeah, the way she plays it, simultaneously defiant, afraid, and resigned, is just... it guts
tremendous.
You. You know
so
who
good.
Else I thought was really good in this movie? Jean Peters.
I saw her with different eyes this time, because I've seen this a couple times before, and I also read this time that they tried to get people like Marilyn Monroe or Ava Gardner or somebody to play that part, and that Fuller specifically did not want somebody of that wattage. He wanted somebody who could be a little down on her luck, a B-girl kind of a person. And Jean Peters is absolutely, she's very attractive and she's very lively, but she is not somebody, she's not Marilyn Monroe slumming by any means.
No, and there's a clever aspect to her performance. When we did Mildred Pierce, we talked about how Anne Blythe plays Vida Pierce, eternally the worst, just got to get that out there, as a dumb person who thinks she's smart. Jean Peters plays Candy as a dumb person who knows that she's dumb and is kind of agonized about it. Like, she knows her own limitations and she's painfully aware of them, and she's doing the best she can with what she has. And despite that, she's so sincere and has this earnest heart that which Richard Widmark's character does not in any way deserve. She's really affecting, especially since this movie does not hesitate to put her through the ringer. And I'm not talking about Richard Widmark punching her in the face and knocking her unconscious the first time they meet. Although there is a great pitch black running gag where Richard Widmark keeps beating her up and then casually stealing her money. What a catch, guys. What a catch.
The idea that they put them together, I mean, he hits her. The thing is that the violence he commits against her, This is going to sound like an odd thing to say, and you may not even agree with it. It's not sexual violence in the sense of I'm beating you up so I can sleep with you or rape you. It's I'm beating you up because I want to steal from you or because you're an obstacle to what I want. And then they almost instantly get into a clinch and she falls in love with him. And he eventually, because that's what the ending tells us, falls in love with her. And it's weird. It's weird that they put them in a relationship.
It's so gross and uncomfortable. It's not, you're right. It's not uncomfortable in a sexualized way, but it's almost worse that it's just, he's like, you are just an object to me. You are not even a person.
He hits her hard.
Yeah.
I mean, he does.
And yet that's not the most brutalized she is in the movie because he's not hurting her to hurt her. He's just hurting her as a means to an end.
Yeah.
You know, which is terrible, but you know, later in the movie, she gets a lot worse. I really enjoyed the dynamism of Fuller's direction here. When a fight breaks out, the choreography is explosive. He has this, and he lets it breathe. He lets it play. He won't cut between a fight. He will move the camera like strategically out and around the scene so that you can watch it play out in as long of an uninterrupted take as he can manage. And especially in the scene where Gene Peters is being attacked, the way the camera stays on it and lingers with it, it draws out the suspense and makes it more horrible and more visceral to watch in a way that I found really impressive. He also does this neat thing in two different shots where a character enters a room and it's a tracking shot and the character walks around and the character is looking at something that we can't see. And then suddenly at the end of this long tracking shot, it's revealed that there's another person in the room that the character knew about, but we didn't. Mo gets that when she comes home and like sets down all her things and lays down on the bed and then looks over and there is a pair of men's feet casually resting on the bed, the man who's come to kill her. And Widmark gets it when he goes back to the coolest flop house in cinema. It is a shack on the edge of a pier. It's got like places you can hide on underneath it. He's got his makeshift ice box / where he hides his loot, which is like a box that he lowers into the ocean to keep his beer cold. It is just the coolest hideout. But he gets that scene where he comes in late at night and wanders around and the camera follows him and doesn't show you the whole scene until he gets back to his hammock and Gene Peters is asleep in it. But you know something's going on because you see him looking in that direction and then back and then looking. It's very clever, this way of creating suspense by making the audience wonder what they're not seeing. And I really like that about Fuller's direction here.
The word that I saw in a lot of the reviews is propulsive, which I think is absolutely a great word. I agree. And I think, too, that sometimes you have a movie like this where there's a lot of action going on, and a lot of camera work around that action. And to me, it can sometimes feel like the director is trying too hard to basically punch you, the audience, in the face. I didn't feel punched in the face by this movie. I mean, there's a lot going on that's, you're uncomfortable and you're feeling bad for characters and you're like, oh no, what's, you know, what you were just speaking about characters not knowing that the other characters in the room, that's great in terms of suspense, but I don't, as an audience member, feel slapped in the face. I mean, the movie, this was actually compared to a movie called Kiss Me Deadly, which I hate. I hate that movie with a passion because it constantly hits you in the face as the viewer, as well as everybody else in the movie. And it's just loud and clangy. And I only bring it up because this movie is sort of an era with it. That was made in 56, I think. But I like the direction. I like the way he stages the shots, like when she's attacked, when her ex-boyfriend comes and is attacking her. I like the wide shot where she, you know, she's shot and she crumples and she's lying there for a while and he's moving around the room trying to find the things that he needs so that he can make his getaway. And the camera stays still and she's just this crumpled lump and you don't know if she's alive or dead. And he's doing all this physical activity that culminates in him stuffing himself in the laundry chute in the kitchen and leaving the apartment. But I like that the action is being directed by the humans as opposed to the camera in that particular scene. That's not always the right thing to do, but I just liked looking at that. I thought it was really well done.
Yeah, it lends scenes like that a humanity and a verisimilitude, if I can break out the $10 words, because again, he's not letting the camera intrude. He's letting the camera capture all the information, but there's no artifice to it to say, it's okay, this is just a movie. You are watching a person in one continuous wide shot getting hurt. And you know, there's no cuts to like subconsciously reassure you that this is something that, that people have made and assembled. So it feels to your brain more real. And it's not that he can't do a stylish, you know, moodily lit intercut sequence right after that. When Richard Kiley's character climbs in the dumbwaiter, there's a great bit of, you know, beautiful noir lighting, you know,
intense
cutting between the detectives looking for him and him, you know, hunched in a tiny, you know.
It takes him forever to get down to the basement.
Yeah. And then like, and then he lunges out of the dumbwaiter and like, beats the cop to death, and a cat is suddenly thrown into the frame, but I still loved it. Yeah, this is a really well-made movie, which I think makes its the problems with its script and the way it was edited more jarring. Because that final, I mean, for one thing, it Widmark's, like I said, Widmark's final change of heart, where Gene Peters has been hospitalized. There's a great motivated camera shot where, you know, Peters is in her hospital bed and the camera moves behind the bars on her headboard to frame Widmark there, which is really just a terrific, intelligent shot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like when he is locked into his course of action. He's going to go get these guys that beat up the woman that only he gets to beat up. But that doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense that he would care enough about this person, you know. Nothing in his character has suggested that even though she took a beating for him, he would care about her at all. Because previously, people have done nice things for him, and he has been like, haha, you chump, I'm going to rip you off anyway. But it does lead to that terrific, and I mean visceral, fight in the subway. The dynamism of the choreography, they're going under and around the turnstiles, and the hits. You know, in old movies, you stage a fight and you can tell they're swinging wide. It doesn't look convincing. It looks like it would in real life, or like the one take of the fight in Rashomon where they're just like pathetically flailing around on the ground with each other. And you know, you're like, yeah, that is what a fight would really look like. This fight feels more modern, like something you would see in Mission Impossible or Jason Bourne, just in its speed and its brutality. And then it gets cut. Like, right as it's getting interesting and good, and then they cut to the police station, like, nope, everything's fine. And I have to wonder if, like, there was more violence or brutality or something that they cut out of that to just skip to, now here's the happy ending we were forced to insert.
Yeah, I don't know. I also like the symmetry of we start in the subway where he's picking her pocket, and we end up in a very different subway late at night at the outside where the trains moving by are very much part of the scene and part of where the danger comes from, because you have, you know, he's chasing the guy and he's gonna kill him, but he could just as easily throw him in front of a train, and the light of the scene comes from the train windows. And it's just really great to look at. But yeah, I don't know why it was cut like this.
Yeah, they have that set up and then they don't do anything with it. It's like, oh, a train could hit us, but no, it won't. Let's go have this fight over here where the trains aren't.
That costs extra. I don't know.
Come on, guys.
And then we go to the police and the worst, okay, we get our happy ending, but worse yet is, I don't remember the tiger's line, but it's basically something to the effect of Widmark will be back here in 6 months on a pickpocket charge. And she's like, oh no, he won't. I just wanted to punch something. I was like, no, what have you done to my movie?
Yeah, I was thinking, come on, this guy has no marketable skills. He is absolutely
right.
going
What's
to go back
to
pickpocketing.
Neither is she.
But then I thought, well, he's an unrepentant grifter who hates women and has no compunctions working for the Russians. He's got a bright future as a Republican Party operative.
There you go. You've solved it. Yeah, I want to talk about the sort of commie, as I say, I don't want to call it a subplot because it's not really. It's an excuse for the movie. So the idea is that Richard Widmark pickpockets Gene Peters on the subway. She is carrying innocently. She's carrying film that is to go to the commies via her creepy killer boyfriend.
Yes, we do establish at least that Gene Peters' character has terrible taste in men.
Yes.
Which, you know, maybe she was being a method actress there. Poor woman.
And so not only is Richard Kiley's character terrible because he kills our friends that we and he kills anybody who gets in his way, but he's a commie. And there are a few lines in the movie to the effect that, as I said before, oh, we may be criminals, but at least we're not commies. But Fuller isn't heavy handed about that because Fuller is not a right wing guy. Fuller is not like, you know, a Sam Wood making My Son John, where he's like trying to do some sort of, you know, anti-communist shtick. That's not what he's doing.
Which is interesting because Fuller is progressive. He's got that awesome movie, The Crimson Kimono, which was one of the first American films to have a Japanese-American hero right. as like the sexy love interest. And the film is chock-a-block with pro-army propaganda. In the subways, there's always all these posters for like, join the army or, you know, give to the army because the Korean War was going on, which makes a nice backdrop and subtext. So, yeah, it is interesting that it's not like explicitly right wing. In fact, J. Edgar Hoover chewed out Daryl F. Zanuck for having Richard Widmark's character be willing to work with the commies. And Zanuck, bless him, told Hoover to pound sand.
Right. And that was specifically the line about flag waving that Hoover didn't like. But one of the reasons I didn't notice the posters particularly, but in that subway scene in the beginning, there's a strap hanger who's a soldier and he's wearing a patch that is for the regiment that Sam Fuller served in World War II. So that's like his. And apparently that resurfaces again when Sam Fuller, as an actor, was in a movie much later. And got to be a general of that, the Big Red One, the first, I can't remember if it's the first, I don't know my military regiments.
First Infantry, I think.
Yeah, that sounds right, but I wasn't certain. But it's interesting because the fact that the commie part is in there means that the contemporary reviews of the movie sort of had opinions about it, but it really doesn't matter. I mean, it really doesn't, because whatever the criminals say about, oh, well, we may be criminals, but we're not commies, it doesn't really change what they do. Because Widmark, whatever change of heart he has and whatever kindness he has toward Mo and eventually toward Candy, the Gene Peters character, it isn't because has any opinions particularly about the commies. And Richard Kiley isn't worse or not worse because he's a commie. He's a killer. He's a bad guy. And Mo has probably the most interesting sort of way of putting it about, well, you know, I may cut a few corners now and then, but at least I'm not a commie. But that's not like a guiding principle of her life. It feels like it's subtext of the movie that's just driven by the time in which the film was made.
And Widmark's not like walking around quoting Karl Marx. He just doesn't care.
It's not relevant to him.
That's like the only good thing about his character is the fact that he is completely disinterested in anything and everyone except himself. It makes him a garbage person, but that's like the one interesting aspect of his character. And the movie fails in part because I think it doesn't commit to that as fully as it could. But I do like the eeriness, the uncanniness that the communism aspect adds. It's almost sinister, almost kind of like, it feels almost Lovecraftian, like kind of cosmic horror, this larger force coming all the way down to intrude on these very small scale mundane events. And I like that about the film. Plus, noir doesn't often get political. You have some political noirs, like I love Crossfire with Robert Ryan, Robert Montgomery, and Robert Mitchum. I guess there was like some rule that they had to make a movie only with guys named Robert.
It's Robert Young. Robert Montgomery wasn't in that one. But, yeah.
Oh, sorry. Robert Young.
There is a title card that says Robert, like all three of the Roberts. Anyway.
And that is an interesting movie because it has an explicitly political angle to it, in part because it's set in D.C. right after World War II when there was a housing shortage. But you don't often get that in noir. So it's an interesting flavor that they add to a very noir movie. And I liked that aspect about it.
I guess I take your point to the extent that I think for an audience that was contemporary at that time, it played different and it played more sinisterly than it does to me from 2022 with a fairly jaundiced eye as far as politics in general and politics in film specifically goes. Because, again, I don't think Fuller is trying to make a point about communism. He's saying, all right, I'm going to use communism as a trope, something that people will sit up and take notice of and recognize and have opinions about. But I don't think he's either trying to curry favor with the Anti-Communist League, nor is he trying to fight them. He's just using what he has.
Yeah, it's just a clever twist, and it's a MacGuffin, basically. It's a way to make whatever Widmark is carrying even more too hot to handle than it already is. If it were just like a mobster's, you know, book or something, it wouldn't have the same like international gravitas that it has when it's something out of an espionage film instead.
But see, what's interesting about that, the idea that all of this is about a roll of microfilm, to Gene Peters, who's carrying it, and to Richard Widmark, who steals it, it has no intrinsic value. It's not even a blackmail document. It's not naked pictures. It's not money. Those things only have value because other people want them. I mean, I guess you could argue that that's the way the economy works in general.
Have you met Bitcoin?
Exactly. But if you look at that piece of film and you don't have any idea what it is, you're looking at it, you know, I could just as well throw this out. I could get rid of it, and of course nobody would believe I had done that, because the problem is not, sure, Richard Widmark would absolutely like to make some coin by selling this in some way, but that's really not what he's trying to do. He's trying to keep it out of the hands of others who would take it from him. I don't know what he thinks he could possibly do to earn money out of it.
He's like, huh, this is interesting. And I do like the scene where he goes to the New York Public Library and uses their microfilm readers.
I know, that's so great.
That's pretty cool. Because, I like that process stuff.
I do too. And I also, the sort of way he approaches the library clerk is sort of out of character a little bit. Could I have this thing? He doesn't seem
no,
a character.
He's a grifter. He's a con man. So he knows how to like blend with the environment so that he can, you know, get what he wants.
I do enjoy the very 50s movie, and 40s and 30s, I guess, the very, very sartorial presence of these movies, where even the bad guy who's in the dumbwaiter and Richard Widmark, who's grifting on the subway, all the dudes are wearing suit and tie the entire time.
And they look great. I mean, in a lot of 1950s movies, you're like, oh, man, those high-waisted slacks are doing you no favors, dude. But here they all look cool.
Even Tiger's all right. Yeah, sometimes the cops get really baggy outfits, but and Richard Kiley did have some high waters.
you can't have a well-dressed cop in a 1950s movie. It is against the rules.
There's absolutely a law.
Tiger's great. I mean, Tiger was apparently based on a real police captain who really did put a suspect in the hospital for 6 months. Yay, police brutality!
All right. But he's on our side or something. I don't know. Anyway. No, but I enjoyed him as a character because he's both a tough cop and somebody who seems to be human. So you're not sort of on your guard for a police officer who is going to be whose story is basically going to be slapping people around. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, he's tough, but he's got this kind of sweet befuddlement about him. Mm-hmm. Like he's trying, you can tell he's trying really hard, and he is a good cop. He's got good instincts, but he also just really doesn't understand. He's so confused about everything that's going on around him and so frustrated about it. And there's something about that that's wonderfully empathetic and funny.
Right. I think characters like Widmark and Skip and Mo sort of befuddle him because they're not behaving and they're not motivated and behaving in a way that makes sense to him, because they're like, okay, could you just tell me what I want to know? Don't beat around the bush and don't make it so difficult on me. And so it's, I don't know. I enjoy it. I enjoy it a lot.
I love watching Tiger and Mo play off each other, the way she just, the way they are clearly friends. And also they are breaking each other's balls.
Yes,
more Mo than Tiger. It's really fun. And also, we should note, yes, Richard Widmark's character is named Skip McCoy, making him arguably the worst human being ever named Skip on screen.
Nomination accepted. The worst human being ever named Skip. If anybody would like to point to other movie characters named Skip that we can hate, feel free to share.
But there's a better version of this movie, though, where Widmark is too much in control of this movie. Too often, you never really feel like he's in danger. He always is one step ahead of everybody. He never seems worried or scared. And there's a much better version of this movie that is probably closer to Night in the City, where he throws away the microfilm, has to scramble to get it back. There's a net closing in on him. He's and he could let this all go and get away scot-free, but he keeps clinging to the idea that he's going to make money until he's ultimately doomed by it. I would really much rather see that movie than this one, where he is a total creep and ultimately gets rewarded for it because he beats up some guys who beat up the girlfriend that he previously beat up.
The Richard Kiley character, because there's a point at which he sent Jean Peters off to find out what happened to the film that was stolen from her. And she comes back and she says, OK, I know who pickpocketed me because Mo has told me. So here's the information. And he says, OK, you need to go back out and you need to get the film. And I would like at that moment in the film, I kind of expected, because I took that as him showing weakness in a way. And I kind of wanted to see him be as terrible as he is, but also scared to death of people like Richard Widmark or anybody who he might have to confront. And so he's sending his woman out to do that kind of work. And I don't know, I thought it would have been fun to give him a scene or two where he's just, you know, a sniveling coward, basically.
But he is kind of. I mean, he clearly, for all the terrible things that he does in this movie, he clearly kind of quails at it. I mean, the one, who does he beat up? An old woman, a tired old woman that he has a gun on, who's unarmed, and his ex-girlfriend, who's just in a bathrobe. So she's not packing heat. She doesn't have
that's
a baseball
true. And,
bat.
And he's got superiors that he's deathly afraid of. I guess I would have liked to see it more explicitly. I think that it's implicit that he's definitely a middleman, and he's scared to death of the people above him who are going to be angry that that film has not gone where it needs to go. Whether he is legitimately a communist or not is never stated. I get the feeling he's more of a thug go-between. You know, what, there are rungs on this ladder that lead up to people who either are running the cell or have true convictions or whatever. But he's in the middle, and he's both scared and scary.
Yeah, he's interesting because he's not a mustache-twirling villain. He's not an ace master spy. He doesn't even seem particularly ideological. He's just a guy, maybe like some struggling businessman who, you know, was willing to sell out his country for a few bucks and then got in over his head. And it's somehow weirdly believable that, like, that guy could be driven to do the bad things that he does. He never becomes like this terrifying nightmare figure. He's always scrambling and hapless and kind of on his back foot. And he only, you know, gets an advantage on people because he has a gun and they don't.
Yeah, I think that's true. And it's interesting the way the character is written, because Richard Kiley could definitely have done it that way. He could have been a much more intimidating sort of character if they had wanted to write him that way. Or presumably he could have been somebody that's even more cowardly and sniveling, and who clearly is having to do the bidding of people above him. And so in order to take out his frustrations, he beats up his ex-girlfriend.
Yeah, but no, he doesn't. You get the sense he does that more because he's scared. And he wants to sever all ties. Yeah.
I know. I think we're agreeing. I'm just saying that I kind of wanted to see it a little bit more, even if only in one scene. I don't want it to be a constant presence because he's scared, but people who are scared are dangerous, clearly, and they kill people.
Yeah.
And I guess I wanted, for my own satisfaction, because he's a bad guy, I guess I kind of wanted to see that at some point.
And the weird thing is, he is loathsome, but he's still not as loathsome as Richard Widmark. And he murders people, and Widmark doesn't. And yet, between the two of them, you're like, okay, that guy's bad because he's a communist, but Widmark, man.
Maybe Tiger can introduce Gene Peters to some nice cop.
Yeah, all I do is beat up suspects. You're fine with me, lady.
Oh, picky. Come on, man. It's the 50s. What are we going to do? There are no perfect men in the 50s. Well, maybe there are a few, but not so many.
I hear that Rock Hudson fella. I hear he's pretty dreamy with the ladies. Oh, wait.
Oopsie. Well, friends, thanks for coming along on the ride to pick up on South Street, which is available, by the way, in a nice Criterion Blu-ray with many special features, including an interview with Sam Fuller and some other cool commentary type stuff. So if you're into physical media, I would definitely recommend you get it. Nathan, thank you so much for being along.
Thank you very much. Now I'm off to reappraise my taste in neckwear.
If you want to follow this podcast, which you absolutely should, please go to theincomparable.com/LTS. While you're there, become an Incomparable member, because it's fun. And every once in a while, yours truly can buy a Coke or a pizza or something on your membership dollars. You can follow the show on Twitter at Lion Tower Shield, because S's cost extra. Bye now.